Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Okay, we're ready. Welcome back. House lights down, please. Let's have some Atmos. Let's do a little bit of housekeeping before we go any further. The next Word in Your Ear is it's not announced yet, but it's on November the 17th. And we're very fortunate. We've got John Savage, who's written a new book about 1966. And we got Howard Sounds, who's written a book about Lou Reed. Howard Sounds, who wrote a... He was the man who found out that Bob Dylan had a love child.
That's right.
Not a love child, married child, whatever. Yeah. Okay. I have to think, people often say that music, it brings people together. I'm never entirely sure that it does, actually. It always seems to be, in my experience, it's quite divisive. And so it's quite interesting to do it, to be talking for the next half an hour or so about a musical subject that actually does sort of bring people together. Because John Peel was the person who, because he was part of everybody's lives, regardless of what generation they belong to, for such a long period of time, that he entered into their lives in all kinds of ways. And oddly enough, sort of ended up kind of more famous than lots of the people whose music he played. And we're talking about a book called Good Night and Good Riddance, How 35 Years of John Peel Helped Shape Modern Britain. And we're joined by Trevor Dan, who worked at Radio 1 for many years and knows his way around radio. And also the author of the book, Dave Kavanagh. So if you please welcome them both. So, Dave, I'll start with you. Just to follow that point, when did he first enter your life? Can you remember?
Yeah, it was July 1976. But I read him before I heard him. I read it because he used to write for Sounds.
Right.
A newspaper about rock music, for those who don't remember it.
We remember, Sam.
And my dad had the idea in the summer of 76 that we would go on holidays on the lakes in Northern Ireland, the Lochs, and he would kind of steer a cabin cruiser around the Lochs while we kind of wore little life jackets and helped him. But actually, I spent the whole holiday in the cabin, the front cabin, reading New Musical Express and Sounds, which I'd bought in a John Menzies in Enniskillen on a foraging kind of grocery hunt trip. And I'd never seen anything like them in my life. I was 11 years old. I loved pop music. I was anxious to sort of know a bit more, like read about proper bands like Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. And I bought NME, well, New Musical Express, as I called it, and Sounds. And this man called John Peel wrote for Sounds. And I thought he was kind of an interesting-looking guy. I couldn't understand a fucking word he was on about because it was all written so ironically, as I later found out. But
it was incredibly funny, those columns.
Well, not to an 11-year-old, believe me.
Frightening.
I probably prefer the Jennings books at that point. but I thought, well, I need to hear him because I knew he was on Radio 1 at night. But in those days, Radio 1 closed down at 7 and then sort of reopened at 10 o'clock. So it wasn't a case of sort of leaving your radio on. Radio 1 stopped and it became Radio 2, and it wasn't kind of easy to know when he'd be on. But the first time I heard him was about July 77. And he played, I think the first thing I remember him playing was The Boys of the Loch. Thanks, mate. You know, that's just what a 12-year-old kid from Northern Ireland wants to hear. And then he played something by, I think, Prince Farai. Again, over my head. Then he played the Sex Pistols. And I was very interested in the idea that this guy who I had in my mind as being quite old, he was probably 39 or 38, but to a 12-year-old, that's very old, endorsed punk endorsed reggae and endorsed Irish folk within the space of 9 minutes. So that first show, even though I didn't necessarily like those three pieces of music, gave me so much to think about that I probably thought it's worth persevering with this guy. And by the end of 77, I was listening to him as many nights as I could stay awake for. Yeah.
So when did he enter your life, Trevor, as a listener?
I listened to him on Pirate Radio London when he arrived there in 1967. And my friend at school, Alan, and I were big fans of John Peel because he just played all this weird stuff. And we didn't really know anything about him except he was different from Tony Blackburn and the other DJs. And then Alan came to school one day and said, John Peel's opening a fete at a girls' school just near where I live. Now, these are not the stories you tell to my learned friends. Yeah. Is there anyone from Yew Tree here? So we found out where it was, and we went along. And there was John with the very long hair and the sandals, and he was opening the fete at this public school for girls. And he did a little speech, which went basically like, I don't know what I'm doing here. Oh, we said we wouldn't do impersonations, did we?
Thankfully you did.
Is that your impersonation?
No, it's finished now.
He's Welsh!
But he thanked us very much for coming and said he didn't know why he was there. And then he signed for me a copy of the programme for this fete. Which I still have to this day, which says, Love and Peace, John Peel.
Very good.
Big hero.
Can you remember when you first...
Oh, well, I've listened to the radio. You and I have talked about this loads of times. There's things you can still remember when you described Emerson, Lake and Palmer as being a waste of talent and electricity. I can remember him playing a thing in 1982. David Bowie had a single called Cat People, brackets, Putting Out Fire. I can remember he said to Fire, one imagines being the name of the cat in question. But I remember because he used to be on every festival when I was a kid. I went to every single rock festival. John Peel was always, I'm sure people remember, he was always the guy playing the records. And at Lincoln Festival, a load of hippies set fire to a hayfield. And he said, you're refrained from doing that because if you were arrested, we couldn't afford the bail. Which I thought was hilarious. You know, I was 16 or something. Yeah. But yeah, that's...
It must have been about 1968 or something like that. I can remember him playing Wheels of Fire, the live version of Crossroads by Cream, and said, for those of you who still think Eric Clapton's human... have a listen to this. And I think he was being flattering.
Yeah, he loved
it. In years later, he would probably have been ironical, you know what I mean, using exactly the same kind of formal words.
He loved Clapton. If there was one kind of untouchable god of Top Gear, it would have been Clapton. And it's weird because by 93, when he sat in for Jackie Brambles for that strange week on Radio 1 at lunchtime...
it's unimaginable.
He had the job of reading out the album chart, and he said number 5, Eric Clapton Unplugged, If Only.
That's true. You should just explain the structure of your book. It's fascinating because you went back to, is it in Caversham? They have the where did you go? Explain what happened because you've got all the details of his program.
Well, I started by. You can hear about 500 or 600 of them online. You can find them and you can hear them. You can download them. You can save them. You can do whatever you want with them. Catalog them. They're there to hear. They will give you a reasonable flavour of his shows from 67 to the final show he ever did. There are gaps, obviously, and some of them are quite serious gaps. And to fill those gaps, you have to go to Caversham, where the BBC's written archive is stored on microfilm, and there you can see the history of Radio 1. Day by day. So you thread in a spool of microfilm, January 1971, for example, right? So Saturday morning, the 1st of January, will come up and it'll be Ed Stewpot Stewart presenting Junior Choice, and you will see 3 pages of every single record that he played and what labels they're on and how long they last. So you keep spooling and you get to Emperor Roscoe's show and then you get to whatever. Finally, you get to Top Gear in the afternoon and then you can see Soft Machine, Vivian Stanshall, Ivor Cutler, Chris McGregor's Brotherhood of Breath, all this stuff, yes, right?
And that was middle of Saturday afternoon, wasn't it, Trevor? Do I remember?
Yeah, he started on Radio 1 doing this show called Top Gear, produced by Bernie Andrews, which was on a Saturday afternoon, and he co-presented it.
Tell everybody.
Okay, well, the clip that I brought is from the very first Top Gear.
Oh, you've got one.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and this is to Peel with Pete Drummond, who is second from the left in the front row with the Savile Row suit on. Third from the left.
One of my favourite groups in the whole world, that probably a great number of people have never heard of, Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band. And I'd like to play this one especially for Shirley, with whom I saw this group in Los Angeles. It's called Yellow Brick Road.
The following tone is a reference tone, recorded at our operating level.
Road from Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band. There's so many fabulous groups over on the West Coast, aren't there, John? You know, they're doing so many different things.
There are indeed beautiful groups, and they all have nice things to do, and none of them ever get heard, except, of course, on Top Gear.
Except, of course, on Top Gear, yes. Right.
Gentle cat.
So that's there is a different tone, isn't there, early on? Tell us about that, Dave.
Well, what intrigued me and what made me think that maybe there's a book in this was that he does sound like two completely different human beings at the beginning and end of his career as a British broadcaster. He's clearly not. He's the same guy. But maybe he had different outlooks and values. Maybe the times were sufficiently different that he made sense in the context of what he's saying there. I just thought, well, if Peel is a chameleon, then it's worth following him through all the different phases and that gets him from psychedelia to punk to drum and bass to grindcore or whatever. Clearly, he is the same person for the duration of his life, but maybe we all change. And I think
do you think there's one particular thing he was looking for? Because it's really interesting in the book that you find him championing all these groups that some he stuck with and still played later on, and some he's appalled by. You know, the Eric Claptons, the Mark Bolans, you know, he's just ashamed that he ever liked them. But is there something all the way through that would have excited? Was it about the newness of what he was doing, or just something adventurous about them?
I think he may have had a strange attitude towards the past. You may not remember, but you sent me to his house once to interview him for Select magazine.
I did, yeah.
Because there was his manager Clive Selwood was putting out a box set on this little label he had, Strange Fruit. That's right, and there weren't that many CD box sets out at the time, so we thought this looks quite interesting. It wasn't Peel Sessions, but it was bands that Peel had first played, and some of them were from the 60s, like Cream or whoever, and then into the punk years, and then the Mary Chain and the Pogues and the Wedding Present and so on. So it seemed fairly comprehensive, and I went down to Suffolk to speak to him. He immediately wasn't interested in this box set. He pretended that he didn't know that it was coming out. He said that he wasn't going to be playing it. He was much more interested in what was going to be in the next show. And it had something to do, and I've never got to the bottom of him. I wasn't his biographer, but my suspicion is that he was a nostalgic person, maybe in private, but when it came to music, he wanted to constantly draw a line under what had happened and almost deny. He had a way of telling anecdotes about people, and Trevor will know, when DJs tell anecdotes about famous stars, they make sure they're in those anecdotes, you know, with the arm around the star at Stringfellow's. Peel had a way of telling stories about Bowie and Bolan. He didn't even appear in the anecdotes. He was modest to the point of almost nullifying his existence in these people's careers. Not only was he not taking credit for the impact he'd had on British music, when, after all, he, more than any DJ in the history of Radio 1, could claim that he'd had an impact on British music, but he was almost writing himself out of history.
He was very wounded when those two people, in particular, he felt abandoned him.
Bowie, you know, and Bolan.
Yeah, they moved on to better things.
I don't think Bowie was particularly wounding to him because they were never close friends. Bowie just sort of drifted away from him, but Bolan, who was his best friend, excommunicated him. But bear in mind that Bolan wasn't just being a prick. Peel had told Bolan that his new songs were shit. He played Get It On and said, "Get It On, I couldn't wait to get it off." He was going, "Mark, what are you doing? All these number one hits, you had it sitting on a carpet with an acoustic guitar while Steve Peregrine tapped away at the bongos. That was it, Mark. You've blown the formula, Mark. All this success and fame.
There's two things I just want to pick up here. That's
Dandelion, the hamster, I think.
Is it Dandelion?
Yeah.
Well, I was looking at this picture last night and I thought, I know the name of that hamster. And I thought it was Dandelion. I thought it was Biscuit. I think it's Biscuit. Now, all I'm saying is...
these hamsters all look alike.
John Peel built an...
How was the night about John Peel? Two people argued about the name of his hamster. We had a brilliant time.
No, it's a serious point here. It's a serious point. Because, you know, he made a feature of not being a radio personality and became the biggest radio personality of all. I don't know the name of the pets of any other Radio 1 DJs.
The key to him that helped me unlock him when I produced his radio show and then later as his boss at Radio 1 was it began to dawn on me that there's John Ravenscroft and then there's John Peel. And John Peel is an invention of John Ravenscroft. You know, he goes off to America and he has to call himself John Ravencroft when he's on the radio, pretending that he comes from Liverpool, whereas actually he comes from the Wirral, which is where that bizarre accent comes from. It's a boy from public school trying to sound like George Harrison. But then he comes back to England and they give him this name on pirate radio. You can call yourself John Peel, they say. So off he goes to be John Peel. And I think John Peel is the character who played the records and was looking for something different all the time, hated the idea that whether it was Janice Long or Kid Jensen or Richard Skinner might find a record before he did, and so he pushed the boundaries and to the point where he's playing unlistenable stuff. But meanwhile, there was John Ravenscroft, who was the guy who loved his family very, very much. If you ever met him for more than 10 minutes, that's what he wanted to talk about. Apart from Liverpool Football Club, was his wife and kids. And he had the perfect family home. He would work very hard at almost anything to keep them in the style in which he thought they had grown accustomed. And eventually, before he died, the real John Ravenscroft emerged doing Home Truths. I think that was more the real John than we heard for 20 years of him playing records on Radio 1.
With respect, I would just like to say one thing. I don't think it's so much that they were Jekyll and Hyde. I think if Mick Houghton is here tonight, Mick and I did the Wimbledon Book Festival a couple of Sundays ago, and Darren Heyman from Hefner was there, and Darren did a session once from Peel Acres, and I said, "Well, how'd you get on with Peel? And, you know, did you become friends?" He said, "It was really difficult to become friends with him because he wouldn't talk about music. The only person who seemed to relate to him from our band was the drummer, who was a football fan." I think music for Peel was a private world and had been since Shrewsbury School. And I think the Peel show was 2 hours of him letting us into his private world. Didn't mean that he necessarily told us what he thought of all those records. Sometimes he would make weirdly jokey comments about them that made you wonder if he'd even listened to them. But he was listening to them, and they affected him very deeply. And sometimes, as in the case of Roy Orbison or the Bundu Boys or whoever, he would cry. Or the Undertones, Teenage Kicks.
So that's a really good point, because I think that I spent the night once down at his place. I was interviewing him and watched him do his show, and we sat up till 3 o'clock in the morning playing records, and he cried twice. Trevor will
back. Oh yeah,
he cried all the time.
Yeah, it was always a blood fest with
cried.
John.
He said, "I'm going to play you. He's going to play the greatest record ever made," which is a standard old joke of ours. Actually, the greatest record ever made in his case was Frankie and Johnny by Lonnie Donegan, and he put it on, and he was in floods of tears, 3 in the morning. And there's a lovely bit in your book where he plays Sergeant Pepper for the first time, cries all the way through listening to it. It's brilliant. And then plays, Day in the Life.
You know, he was a lonely, isolated boy in a 1950s boarding school,
yeah, yeah,
who didn't know anybody who shared his taste in music. That's a long time to be isolated.
And then when he went to Dallas when he was about 23, I think.
21.
Or,
yeah.
21.
Yeah.
He set up some speakers. I remember him telling me he set up some speakers by the bus stop, wired up to his record player, and he would sit there all day playing his favourite record. It's just evangelical, is the word, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Wanting to see people waiting for the bus excited by the records he's playing, were mostly records by people like Carl Perkins, probably, and old rock and roll records. And that kind of, so you had that evangelism of wanting to play on national radio two to a quarter million people.
And I know people, you know, who sat,
so a very competitive thing.
But I know see people who sat in on his show, friends of mine who, you know, were fans of his and managed to sit in on Peel programs. And he was, you know, he didn't like them being there. He needed that private relationship. Now, Bruno Brooks.
That's really, really true. That's he hated that.
Yeah. That's a really interesting point, that he had a private relationship, because my only anecdote took place in Tokyo, Japan. At the end of I'd gone with BBC Television, he was with BBC Radio to do a week of programmes in Tokyo. And after working very hard for a week, there was a last night booze up in what I can only describe as a disco. And everybody was letting their hair down in front of a load of Japanese people that you were never going to see again in your life. Peel's wife was there. Johnny Beerling, boss of Radio 1 at the time, was there. Mike Appleton was there. All the production staff were there. They were on the dance floor, giving it loads to whatever was the hit of the time. Could they get John Peel onto that dance floor? Could his wife get him onto the dance floor? No, because that was locked away inside, that he couldn't bring himself to enjoy music in the most natural way that you can possibly enjoy it, which is dancing. It's what most people do. Because he had to be this, he'd learned that it was this internal thing. And your response was tears very often, more than anything else.
And don't forget, he didn't get to see as many gigs as we would have done, because he would have been on the air at the time that they were starting. Morrissey, in his autobiography, actually gives Peel quite a hard time. He's saying, you know, call yourself a Smiths fan, you never saw us live. But it's because Smiths went on stage just as Peel was in Egton House or wherever, starting his show. He probably saw four or five gigs a year.
I thought I might tell you how he used to put his show together, in case people don't know this.
Yeah, go on.
I produced him for about 7 months, I think, in 1983, because they'd given me the equivalent of the death sentence at Radio 1, which is, you are producing Simon Bates. And fortunately, I'd applied for a job in the television, which I then got. So they said, OK, well, you can't go, obviously, straight away, so we can't have a temporary producer for Simon. So, tell you what, we'll take Chris Lycett off the Peel show, and he can do Simon, and you can do Peel for a few months. He won't mind. Well, of course, he did. He was very cross about this. But I made friends with him very quickly by saying, how does the running order come together then, John? Because I knew that he picked all the records. And he said, well, basically, I go through the albums and I put star ratings on the sleeves and I time all the tracks. And then John Walters, or Chris Lice, as it was then, will go through the list that I've given them. And basically, if they see two records with the word fire in them, they put them together. They think that's very clever. And he's very dismissive about how they put these running orders together. So I said, well, why don't you do it? He said, oh, really? He was genuinely pleased that I'd let him do this. Whereas I was thinking, well, you know, he's a DJ. He's picked all these bloody records. He ought to put them in order. They'll sound much better. And he was childishly happy about this. And it gave me so much pleasure over that few months. And just one final point. I think I'm one of the few people who got a request, or a dedication, rather, on the Peel show. Because when I left, so I'd had this kind of fiery relationship with him, saying, I know you want to play new stuff, but why don't you occasionally play old stuff that your new listeners have never heard, and which is new to them? And he said, no, I can't do that, I can't do that. And then when I left, the last record on the last show I produced was Interstellar Overdrive, which he thought was, you know, was making an effort.
What do you think, Mark? I mean, because you sat in for him, didn't you?
I did.
You know, even though he watched you through the glass like a hawk, in case you were pinching his job.
Have I told that? I did his show. I was very, very nervous. Terrified, actually.
Do you know what he said about you?
Don't tell me.
No, he just said he talks too much.
Oh, yeah. From him?
Well,
coming from him.
Would anybody argue about
that? Come here and say that.
Yeah. No, I did a show, and on the first night he arrived, and I was told he was on holiday, he arrived, and I could see him looking through the glass. I had even met him once for a huge hero of mine, so I was completely overcome. Put on a 12-inch record to buy a little bit of time, went out to talk to him, and he looked at the microphone, and he said, it's like letting somebody borrow your toothbrush or sleep with your wife. I.e. me doing his show. That's how strongly he felt about it. But so, my God, no.
So I was going to ask a question. I mean, what made him so good as just a simple DJ, regardless of the music he played?
Oh, right. Well, that's a really good question. The Radio 1 at the time, actually still suffering from this a little bit, was going through what I suppose you would call a zoo format thing. There's Steve Wright, who's still there, actually. You started to do a show where he had a gang around him, the Posse. And it became a thing where you talked to people all the time. You talked to the people in the room, and effectively people were just eavesdropping on a show that was going on, which isn't a very intimate relationship. And Peel, more than anyone else I've ever understood, really understood the nature of late-night radio. It's an amazing thing, and I've done quite a bit of it, actually. It's amazing how it changes from 10 o'clock to midnight and beyond. 3 a.m, incredible. At 10 o'clock at night, the people you're talking to are often listening to the radio on their own. They're on their own, they're trying to do some homework, or they're trying to read a book, or they're in bed, and they're trying to go to sleep, or they're operating machinery, or they're driving a cab. They're on their own. And that incredible intimacy is extraordinary. And he really, really understood the idea of saying these things as if he was talking to simply one person. And every phrase, Dave mentions this in his book, that people used to listen to the programme by the end, to hear what he had to say. They were almost more interested in the way he expressed himself, that incredibly convoluted...
Can we hear the clip where he starts off talking about Liverpool? Have you got that?
Yeah, I think it's 1982.
It's
Liverpool.
The beginning of a show where Forest and Liverpool have just played.
Well, guess who's back on top of the First Division tonight? It sounds like a blinder of a match. Forest leading 3-2 at half-time at Anfield. Liverpool won 4-3 in the end. Hodgson 2, Souness and Rush. And anyway, into the programme, we've got the Sisters of Mercy and the Beat amongst the records. Comsat Angels, the Gun Club, a little surf music, because I like you. Red Lorry, Yellow Lorry, Lee Perry, Hunters and Collectors, Personal Column, Deutsche Amerikanische Freundschaft, Ludus, Birthday Party, French Impressionists, The Mad Professor, Meat Puppets, Sunny A Day, and to start the programme, Dead or Alive.
Now, by any standards, that's terrible, isn't it? You know, that breaks all the rules, and yet it's really.
But it's really thought about, isn't it? Yeah. As little surf music, because I like you.
Yeah.
You know, he's composed it. I've got it written down as well.
You know, he used to invent a band that he used to interpolate into these introductions. It were called the Flying Cream Shots, because he'd once seen this phrase in a Dutch porno mag. And so, and he used to say the red lorry yellow flying cream shots. And
that's just a joke for him. No, to amuse himself. Also, another thing I thought was very funny about the way he did it, he used to just, that way he spoke, that convoluted way he spoke, that in a sense, if I'm any judge, you know, which has not yet been proved to any conclusive degree, you know, what he was actually doing was buying time, because sometimes he didn't really know what record he was going to play. Yeah. And he would just talk and
but
film,
he always sounds as if he did.
Yeah, it became...
He always sounds as if he knew exactly where it was going. Yeah. But even though, as you say, he must have been buying time like anybody was.
Very important because... the brevity of the songs or the violence of the delivery or something, the immediacy of the message really did change the way that he broadcast. And there were many examples of shows around 75, early 76, where I started to get very impatient listening to him. There was one towards the end of 75 where he's playing his top 15 singles of the year, and the theme tune plays, and he says, well, tonight I'm going to be playing the best 50, well, so what I consider to be the best 15 record, well, certainly singles of the year, and I hope you'll find it interesting. You may not, of course, but and you're just thinking, it's your fucking programme. Take control. Assert yourself, for Christ's sake. You've lost them. It's 19 seconds into the programme, and they're fucking drifting away. But anyway, but that was him. He was just so incredibly kind of apologetic about... But from punk onwards, then it was, thanks for listening, good night, and good riddance.
Now, throughout the career, he was a festival fixture, wasn't he? Wasn't he turning up?
Yeah, absolutely.
Playing Nelly the Elephant at Reading Festival and so forth. And
he loved doing it, although he always used to complain, didn't he? He always used to say, oh, I've got to do this, and the Peel Road Show and all this. But, of course, actually, one of the things that he did it for was he made a lot of money. And because you didn't make any money really as a BBC DJ.
So
in those
how much
days.
Would have you been making? We're not. This is not commercial confidence. In 1980, how much would John Peel be making out of radio?
1980.
Yeah.
He might have got.
It was on four nights a week.
It was four nights a week. He had 200 a show.
That's terrible. And by then he had three kids.
So that's why he did the ads,
yeah.
You know, all the other things.
But he didn't. That's why he went around the country in the John Peel Roadshow, just doing kind of discos. But the only thing about that was that inevitably he'd come back with 20 more demo tapes than he'd had before he'd left the house, which he felt obliged to listen to.
Why? See, that's interesting. Why did? Because he did. When I went to his house, he had a big pile of jiffy bags that he took, and there were people would send. When I did the show, I've still got some in the attic. Old people would send fanzines, cassette tapes, their poems, anything, and he felt obliged to write back to all of them.
I think it starts with a show in August 1977, which a lot of Peel aficionados know as the second punk special, and the significance of that is, unlike the first punk special, which was December 76 and was a response to the Grundy incident, when there were very few British punk singles, only two in fact, the Pistols and the Damned, by August 77 there were loads, and they were coming from all over Britain, not just London. So he played 2 hours worth of British punk, 38 songs in 2 hours. And the significant thing, well, two significant things, most of them were from bands outside London, and a lot of them were from bands who'd set up their own record labels. They weren't going to go to EMI or Chrysalis or Polydor. They were just going to... They'd read about the Desperate Bicycles doing it themselves or the Buzzcocks, and they thought, we can do this. And John Peel made it absolutely clear to these bands, send them to me, I'll put you on the radio. And that's where his life, the Peel Show, and the lives of so many indie post-punk and punk bands changed forever.
And that's what kept him in business, actually, with the BBC, because they could then wheel him out in front of any, you know,
committee,
House of Commons investigation, BBC Charter Review.
Well, it's community service, isn't it? It's
community
public service radio, isn't it?
Yeah, it was public service radio, and there was the BBC... looking after young artists in a way that commercial radio didn't.
Yeah.
And so they might bury him away in the middle of the night, but the BBC needed him for many, many years so that they could say
and also
that they
so
were a cultural patron.
What was going on in those daytime shows? He had this absolute loathing for Dave Lee Travis, who I noticed you do too in your book, actually.
Do I?
Who?
Funny.
Do I?
I think you rather went on about how much you didn't like it,
I don't remember him hating DLT. I remember him calling Simon Bates Simon Beast, which is an anagram of his surname.
Oh, right.
But
he wanted to be seen to be doing things differently because he knew that a lot of those guys didn't listen to the records.
May we play the Christmas party clip? This is John Peel at the Radio 1 Christmas Panto, where he's reading something which they've given him to read. And
this
I think
is a Snow White thing.
This is Snow White. I think it's really interesting that they've given him a line to read about how his show is enjoyed by schoolgirls. Okay, so there's something going on in here, but just listen to what he says.
Hi-ho, 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 hi-ho.
Hello, fans. Snow White's the name. You all must know my claim to fame. I live inside a woodland den, alone except for seven men. With all these males around the house, it is not rare to hear them grouse. We're bored and want something to do. So I bought each one a radio. They each became the greatest fan of just one BBC programme. They'd hurry up the evening meal, lest they should miss the great John Peel. His Top Gear is a wondrous thing, all shimmering in greens and reds, a witching screen of melody, beloved of schoolgirls, freaks and teds. He himself is modest, kind, a rugged, daring, lovely man. To his true worth, he remains as blind as only a Liverpool supporter can.
So that was the personality they kind of designed for him. So he was always throughout his career. He always felt that he was going to get the chop at any time, but it never happened, did it?
No, it never happened. Largely because I think, as I say, he was wheeled out as the cultural patron, but also because. Everybody liked him. you know, even though he was a difficult man, he was, as David said, he was a difficult man to like. He had this, that fantastic relationship with John Walters, where one of them said of the other, we're like a man and his dog, in which both of us think the other one's the dog.
Yeah, right.
And but I think in the end, he was the guy nobody dared to get rid of. You know, Matthew Bannister certainly would have never got rid of him, neither would Andy Parfit. Everybody loved him because of partly what he was and partly what he had been.
It's hard to imagine, but he would be actually able to work it out. He'd be 76 now. Do you think he would still be at Radio 1 age 76?
No, I don't. But I do think I think he'd have moved to Radio 2.
Yeah.
And I think he'd be big on Radio 4. Yeah. I truly do.
What I want to know, sorry.
Yeah.
You two did Live Aid. Did you ever hear any kind of whisper of John Peel being asked to do Live Aid? He was the only person who'd ever played African music on Radio 1, and yet he wasn't even involved in Live Aid.
I don't think they asked him.
He wouldn't do it.
And I think he probably...
Well, he was asked and wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Oh, really, was he? Okay. Well, that's interesting. I was going to ask you, Dave, one thing is, there was a major change, which you were alluding to earlier on, actually, when they put on this programme with Dave, Kit Jensen, I think, was presenting it, and then it was Janice Longfield, between 8 and 10, and that really stole a little bit of his thunder, because at that point he was playing, you know, Wah Heat, and, I don't know, the Pale Fountains, and I don't know, all sorts of groups, Orange Juice, whatever, and suddenly those things were then being played by them. And at that point, he was pushed further up the scale to find more and more challenging stuff. And do you feel, Dave, because you've listened to many more of these programs than I have, do you feel that he was then often just putting on things because he felt that they were a story, that they were, you know, Einstein sent a Neubau, you know, people drilling the concrete floors of dance halls? Do you think he liked it or just thought it was an art statement that should be encouraged?
If there's one thing that I think connects every single piece of music that he ever played, it's not the fact that he liked them all, it's the fact that he had an instinctive sense of when they deserved to be played on the radio. Now, that's different from liking it.
Yeah.
And if he felt that this piece of music, whether it be old, new, obscure, unheard of, uncommercial, whatever, from any part of the world, he was playing indigenous folk music on Night Ride in 1968. He was playing 78 in 2003. Whatever it was, if he felt that it merited, and merit was a word that he used, if this record had merit and deserved to be played on the radio, he knew enough about Radio 1 to know that nobody else would play it, except possibly Andy Kershaw during that period in the mid-80s. Yeah. So it might as well be him, and it might as well be tonight.
There was a guy he told me about called, I think it was called Mertzbo. I can't remember how you pronounce it.
Yes.
And Mertzbo had a 3-day event at Colchester Arts Centre where he played all the music he'd ever recorded. It took 3 days, 24 hours a day to do it. And Peel, I think, actually opened this event. He didn't stay for more than 20 minutes of the 3 days of music, but he did open it, and he wanted to be seen to support that. And I like that idea.
Yeah, but also, I don't agree with this unlistenable stuff. There's no such thing as unlistenable music. There's just people who don't want to listen to it. So Peel was a person who listened. He got into work at some ridiculous hour of the morning. First time I ever met him, he said, well, if you get here at 8 o'clock, and I thought he meant 8 o'clock in the evening, 2 hours before his show started. No, he meant 8 o'clock in the morning, because he'd spent the night at his mother's flat in Notting Hill, and he got in that hour of the morning, and we had breakfast, and I said, what are you doing now? And he said, well, I'm, you know, listening to records, you know, trying to find two or three last-minute inclusions to put into tonight's show.
And would occasionally jump on his bike and bicycle down to Rough Trade Records.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, well, it would definitely go to HMV, or the local, you know, Tower existed in those days. CDs had just come in, so his post bag would have been enormous without him even having to look for records, but he did that. He felt that that was part of his job.
So if he was still with us, he'd be, what did we say, 76?
76.
And by the way, I believe he still would be on Radio 1, because if you think of the Twitter outcry if they tried to sack him, that's when Bowie, so Elton, Rod, all of them would come out of the woodwork.
So you think he'd still be on Radio 1?
Yes.
Trevor thinks he'd be on Radio 4.
Yeah.
I think if he only knew anything about cricket, he'd be on Test Match Special. Absolutely brilliant.
He'd still be doing Home Truths.
Yeah.
Well, okay, yeah. Well, it's... And he's, you know, he's a figure who continues to fascinate us all, and his heritage is immensely powerful. And he is recorded in this book, Good Night and Good Riddance, How 35 Years of John Peel Helped Shape Modern Britain, which Dave, I'm sure, would be happy to sign a copy for you on your way out. Would you now just thank Trevor Dann and Dave Gavin?
This podcast is brought to you by The Word.